Join Mark and Molly Hemingway, Brian Wolfmiller, Rod Dreher, Jennifer Roback Morse, Scott Murray, and me for the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
And they won't ask me questions.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I don't know where the term came from, but it certainly is with us now. It's not only with us as a term, identity politics, it's with us as a political reality. But can we even call it politics? It doesn't seem to have the same kind of mechanism as ordinary politics. Yes, there's protest, but the protest seems to be unfocused. Everybody at the protest has their own particular issue, and they're just protesting, well, whatever it seems that has them angry. And boy, are they angry. One of the features of identity politics, both on the right and the left, is how quickly it can turn from mere emotion, yelling and screaming, waving of signs, to violence. We're going to be talking about identity politics and what may be behind it. Mary Eberstadt joins us on this Tuesday afternoon. She's senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute, author of the books It's Dangerous to Believe and How the West Really Lost God, and a recent column for the Weekly Standard titled The Primal Scream of Identity Politics. Mary, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be here.
You refer to what happens routinely now on many U.S. college and university campuses as dangerous collective hysteria. What do you mean by that?
Well, there seems to be this feeling out there that, you know, the kids are all right, that it's just protest as usual on college campuses. But if you look at the facts of what's been happening over the last few years, especially, you get a very different picture. For example, at Middlebury College in the spring, Charles Murray and a professor who was hosting him were literally attacked by a mob of young people. The professor ended up in the hospital, in fact. This, to me, is an example of the kind of unreason that we are seeing with increasing frequency on campuses. It isn't just that people are objecting to ideas that they don't hold. It's that there seems to be some kind of collective unreason that is accelerating out there. Christina Hoff Sommers, who's been the object of protests all over the place, recently said that what she has seen makes her think that students need deprogrammers. She described the protests as very cult-like. So that's the reality of the emotional level, the emotional decibel level behind identity politics. And that's what I was trying to get at in the essays, to understand what that rank emotionalism is about.
Do progressives, secular progressives, do they understand? They seem concerned. You talk about a rift among progressives and liberals on identity politics, but do they seem to understand what they have unleashed in American society?
No, I don't think they do. Even though there is a debate underway on the progressive side about whether identity politics is a good thing or a bad thing, there are people who think that the liberal side won't win elections anymore unless they dispense with some of this emotional stuff. But even though there's that debate, Todd, I don't think they have a clue about what's really motivating these students, especially, to go so far beyond any kind of rationalism that their actions are actually inexplicable. Look what happened at Berkeley, $100,000 in damages because of a riot concerning one speaker. And my point is that it's not just the truly fringe speakers, you know, neo-Nazis, white nationalists, who are the object of this kind of ferocity. Conservatives are routinely shouted down, disinvited, harassed out of all proportion to any visible damage that they're causing to the student body. So So again, we're dealing with a massive irrationalism. And the point of my article was that the conventional explanations for this irrationalism really don't hold up. Liberals will say, well, it's all about injustice. There is injustice in the world, but this decibel level of emotionalism exists whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about sex. There are all kinds of injustices, but no single injustice explains why so many people are inflamed about identity politics and inflamed in the same very emotional way. So I was trying to get at the underlying reality to ask the question, why do they feel this way? And for once, take seriously the fact that they are feeling something deep.
It isn't just a phenomenon of the left, you say. There is identity politics at work on both sides.
Yes, and I give some examples of that in the piece. So we can't just dismiss this as something that is the product of overly attentive parenting, for example, which is what some people believe. We can't just dismiss this as the complainings of spoiled American brats, which is what other people seem to want to do. You know, there's that word snowflake that is designed to deride people for these kinds of protests, especially in this kind of sensitivity. But I'm taking a very different tack to that. I'm saying that there is something authentic there, that this emotionalism is not made up. But I don't think it's coming from the places that liberals and progressives say it is. I think it's coming from something much deeper, which is the dissolution of the family, the unraveling of familial ties over the last 50 years, especially. It's very telling, Todd, that we never talked about identity politics until we had this change in family formation. And it's connecting those dots that I think is the key to understanding what identity politics is all about. These people are screaming for answers to the question, who am I? Because the most elemental way of answering that question, I am a mother, I am a son, I am a niece, I am a grandfather, etc., has been taken away from a great many people in the world of the fractured family.
So in other words, we're talking about a genuine quest for identity that isn't merely self-indulgence or self-involvement. It is, in fact, something that is being driven by a complete disconnectedness from anything that could answer those questions for the people involved.
Yes, I think that's true. The old ways of forming identity, of looking around oneself from childhood onward and seeing where one belonged in a family, and I don't just mean the nuclear family, I mean the extended family, all of that has been upended. I give a lot of examples in the piece of what kind of person am I if my parents are divorced and my father has acquired a new wife and she came with children of her own? What is my relationship to her, to them? What is my relationship to other kinds of family fracturing? A lot of us don't have solid answers to these questions anymore. They're not answered for us in childhood and by virtue of our family formation. And that, I think, is what's really driving this search for tribes with which to identify, whether they are ethnic in nature or ideological in nature or otherwise. There's obviously a real, authentic hunger out there for answers to the question, who am I, in a way that we didn't used to see before.
You have used the term irrationalism, emotionalism. Why do these two things characterize identity politics so often? Ideas are secondary to just raw feeling.
Well, all of us want to answer that question, who am I, what is my purpose here, etc. And again, in a society where a great many people are deprived of easy answers to that question by virtue of family fracturing, and not just family fracturing, but also the shrinkage of the family, people have many fewer biological relations with which to identify than they used to have. And I'm not saying that in order to glamorize, you know, days gone by, or to turn back the clock to the 50s or any of that sort of thing. I'm just making an observation that there are fewer and fewer ways of answering that question by reference to the family unit. And everybody wants those questions answered. There is no more important question in human existence than who am I? And as a related matter, what am I here for? So, of course, there's a very deep human need that's driving these primal attachments to groups as a substitute for the even more primal attachment of family that so many people don't have anymore.
Why do you think it is so often, especially when it kind of aggregated into groups, condensed on the college campus, why is it so often easily turned toward anger and toward violence?
Well, that's a great question, Todd. I think the violence that we see sometimes, as in the example of what happened at Middlebury, speaks to, again, just how deep this longing goes. It goes so deep that people feel as if they can defend the tribe to which they're attached with the ultimate resort to harming others. And that, again, speaks to the authenticity of this feeling. It doesn't make the violence justifiable, of course, but it does speak to the felt need that people have to attach and defend. And again, the most natural way of attaching and defending, at least in human society and in other kinds of mammalian society, is attaching and defending to one's own. A lot of people don't know who their own is anymore.
We're talking about identity politics. Mary Eberstadt is our guest, senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute, author of the books It's Dangerous to Believe and How the West Really Lost God. She's written a recent column for the Weekly Standard titled The Primal Scream of Identity Politics. Why is it that so much of identity politics, the movement, the campus movements, have no identifiable leaders or even goals? We'll answer that after this.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Religious liberty, Christians engaging the media, the for you of Christianity, Christian marriage, the sexual revolution, the Benedict option. These are some of the topics for the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $120. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about identity politics. Mary Eberstadt is our guest, author of a recent column for the Weekly Standard titled The Primal Scream of Identity Politics. One of the things I have failed to notice, I guess I should say, and I can't say I have searched that hard for it, but usually you know when there are movements like this who the leaders are, but I haven't been able to discern any identifiable leadership, much less any identifiable overall goals for identity politics.
No, and its diffuse nature also tells us something about how widespread this desire to attach and defend seems to be out there. Because you're right, Todd, there isn't any identifiable leader. There are, of course, bad actors who put on masks and deliberately cause violence just because it seems to be some kind of entertainment for them. But I would distinguish that phenomenon that we also see in some places from the existence of a very real and authentic pain on the part of these students. When you watch some of these protests and you see people crying or duct taping their mouths shut or behaving in ways that are otherwise inexplicable, you have to assume that they are feeling something real. And I think this is where some on the conservative side have gone astray, because they've just assumed that there isn't a reality there. What I'm saying is something different. I think there is a there, but it's coming from a very different place than we've understood.
Distinguish this, what we're seeing today, from the civil rights movement, where we had an entire group of people easily identifiable, in this case, by skin color, and who had legitimate and long-lasting grievances that were both personal and communal. And yet, although there was violence involved in the civil rights movement, it tended to manifest itself in nonviolence, in passive resistance. What's the difference?
That's exactly the right comparison, Todd. The civil rights movement was created by people who knew the answer to that question, who am I? Who am I? I am a Black American. I am someone demanding the rights that all Americans have. These were people who knew what they were about. They weren't searching for just any old identity or any old group of people to join. And it's very telling because the civil rights movement is coming right before the beginning of the great familial crackup. People were still coming from a place where their identity had been formed in childhood and adolescence with relation to family members and communities. And that makes all the difference in the world. It's why the civil rights protests were nonviolent and also effective, by the way, in a way that today's protests are not. The most effective thing that today's protests are accomplishing is to inspire fear in some people, disgust in other people, and just plain puzzlement in still others. What I'm trying to do is explain away that puzzlement by saying, look, these people are being driven by something very different than what drove the civil rights protests or even the Vietnam War protests. We didn't see this kind of behavior even then. There's something new on the scene, and I think it's coming from the fracturing of the family and what that has done to the fracturing of individual identities.
In the protests against discrimination and against segregation, the enemy were these various ideas about segregation and the laws that codified them. The Vietnam War, the enemy was a military-industrial complex that appeared to be making war merely for profit's sake or for war's sake, whether that's right or wrong, but there was an identifiable enemy. And then, of course, the institutions that made those things possible. What's the enemy in identity politics and the protests that are carried out in its name?
Well, that's another great question, because some of the protesters would say, obviously, the enemy is white supremacy. But white supremacy doesn't explain why we have, for example, so many ardent sexual identitarians. Look at the passion that attaches to that, that attaches to the same-sex marriage debate or to discussions today about transgenderism or intersex, et cetera. Well, you could say sexual prejudice accounts for that group of people, but then sexual prejudice doesn't explain what the feminists are about or all the different parts of the identity coalition. There is no single overarching answer from that corner about why are we all in this? And what I'm trying to do is supply an answer and to say, in effect, you're in this because the world has changed. And what's motivating you is something very deep that's not going to be fixed by violence and, you know, attaching onto another group. We've got a reason together about how this kind of problem gets fixed down the road. But you're absolutely right. There is no single idea that these people are rebelling against. There isn't even anything that you could put into a coherent sentence that unites them all, except that they all want to know the answer to that question, who am I? And that's why they're asserting it so passionately and sometimes ferociously with these group identities that they've come up with.
There are sometimes political goals or aims that are stated, but I wonder, they're very few and far between. What exactly do you want us to do? What exactly do you want to change in society, in law? Those kind of questions don't seem to be relevant.
No, a great deal of what's being done is just shouting down the other side and getting some kind of catharsis out of those experiences. I was just hearing today about another example in which college Republicans at a campus in California were having an ordinary meeting of their campus club, and they were surrounded by students who went and got more students who started calling them names like KKK and Nazi and, you know, other things that the college Republicans manifestly were not. But the whole point of the exercise was to disrupt them and keep them from being able to meet. This, again, is not politics as usual. This is some newly unhinged element that's been introduced to the political conversation, and it's becoming more and more powerful over time, and which is another reason why I think we need to try and understand it.
In my more cynical moments, I wonder whether or not the goal simply is to end political conversation altogether. I mean, when you see the protests against free speech, when you see college students writing with a straight face essays on eliminating the First Amendment or major portions of it, it is, I wonder whether or not they simply want to isolate themselves from anyone who would say anything that might either offend or cause any kind of agitation.
Well, they do seem to want that, and we have to ask ourselves how they ever got to that level of sensitivity. How is it that in a world with real problems, all of a sudden people are arguing over things like Halloween costumes? How fragile does your sense of identity have to be if you need to take offense at something that seemingly trivial? I mean, these are the kind of questions, Todd, that I think we need to be asking about identity politics. Why are all of these people so fragile? Now, one interesting explanation is the internet. And I think that is a very informed way of looking at this. In other words, that the internet explains some of what we see out there, because people get inflamed by social media. They do things that they would never have done otherwise, like get in a car and go to a protest 500 miles away, etc. There is some truth to that, but social media as an explanation also doesn't hold up altogether, because, first of all, identity politics actually started before the internet, so therefore it can't be explained by it. And second, although it does make matters worse, it's clear that even social media can't create the kind of emotion that we see on these young faces at these protests. There's something real there.
You write, the question is no longer whether Google is making us stupid, as Nicholas Carr put it in 2008. That sounds awfully quaint now. It's instead whether Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram are driving many to mutually assured social destruction. What are you talking about there?
I'm talking about the role that social media plays in these unfolding patterns of intimidation that we keep seeing on campus. For example, several years ago, there was a prototype. It actually happened at Oxford, England. A debate had been scheduled over the question of abortion. And suddenly, using social media, various progressive and feminist and other student groups sent messages around to one another saying, we've got to stop this thing. So let's demand extra security. Let's put pressure on the prospective hosts. And let's get this thing shut down. Well, they actually did, Todd, and they did it at a college where John Locke is buried, interestingly enough. I always thought that detail was especially telling. But the point is, the use of social media to intimidate and preemptively censor people, whether they're speakers or students or anyone who the identitarians might take issue with.
I want you to talk about another incident. Actually, it's a series of incidents at Evergreen State College, notoriously progressive place of higher learning. But there's kind of a progressive puzzlement there, even among the faculty members who've become liberals and progressives themselves, have become targets of this kind of thing.
Yes, they have. And it's interesting that when you look at the liberals who are starting to question this, you find a generational gap. I get into this a little bit in the essay. You find that it's older people, some of them veterans, as they like to call themselves, of the protests of the 60s, who really don't understand today's identitarians. And on the other hand, for the millennial generation, this seems to be their preferred way of expressing themselves politically, at least in the cases of many millennials. And my point, again, is the difference in those two groups is the difference in what's happened to the family over time. That older generation is still coming out of a place where there were more intact families, there were more intact communities, and the question of identity was being settled in more traditional ways. Whereas for the millennials, again, we see this hunger to attach, to throw one's passions into a group identity of some kind, and not to hear otherwise, to never hear anything that questions that this is their fundamental attachment in life. I find that very interesting, because for most of humanity, for most of recorded history, the answer to the question of attachment was, of course, one's family, one's nearest and dearest, one's own. And again, a lot of people don't seem to know who their own are anymore, whether literally or figuratively.
Mary Eberstadt is our guest. We're talking identity politics. When we come back, what identities in the panoply of identity politics have gained the most from this approach?
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years.
Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Emily finally had to face the truth. Her church choir was a mess.
Katie Schuerman from her new audiobook, House of Living Stones.
Sure, they'd managed to turn out a few decent choral offerings for Sunday worship every now and then, but their confidence and morale were presently hanging lower than pants on a wrapper.
You can purchase and download an audio version of the novel House of Living Stones at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. House of Living Stones by Katie Schuerman.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Expert guests, expansive topics, extolling Christ. That's exactly what you'll find at this week's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. That's this Friday and Saturday. You can meet and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Pastor Brian Wolfmiller, Rod Dreher, Dr. Scott Murray, and Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, speaking on topics like religious liberty, Christians engaging the news media, the 4U of Christianity, the Benedict option, Christian marriage, and the sexual revolution. You can register for only $80, but your registration fee won't include meals and child care at this late date. Register online at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston. We're talking about identity politics. Mary Eberstadt is our guest, author of the books It's Dangerous to Believe, How the West Really Lost God, and a recent column for the Weekly Standard titled The Primal Scream of Identity Politics. What identities in all of the many that are represented in this kind of catch-all term, what identities have gained the most from identity politics, Mary?
Well, so far, you would have to say it's the sexual identitarians. The debate over same-sex marriage was one of the most important in the country up until the Obergefell decision that settled it. Now we have the question of transgenderism and the bathroom wars and accommodations that are supposed to be made about that. But I think this is an especially interesting group because in the beginning and for many years, the argument was made that, for example, same-sex marriage should be legal because people are born that way and they can no more change anything about that than they can change skin color or chromosomes or et cetera. And I think that argument was very persuasive and moving to many people. On the other hand, now when it comes to transgenderism, a completely different and, in fact, logically opposed argument is being made, which is that identity is somehow fluid, that sexual identity comes and goes, and that no one can say what it is or what it should be. So the point of putting these two arguments next to each other is to say, here we have a very clear example of how identity politics is not ruled by reason. It's ruled by emotion. Because reason, I mean, as a matter of logic, those arguments cannot both be true at the same time. They're diametrically opposed to one another. It tells us that something besides reason and logic is ruling identity politics itself. And again, I think that thing is a deep human need to know the answer to the question, who am I, in an age when the traditional ways of answering that have been torpedoed for many people.
Talk a bit about what gives this a little more impetus and heft in American political life, and that is what I will just simply refer to as a mass of kind of fellow travelers that orbit this thing farther out. And they don't necessarily
glom onto any one identity, but they do buy into this notion that history is essentially the story of the enfranchised disenfranchising others and the powerful oppressing everyone else. Talk about the fellow travelers in American political life.
Well, I think, as with anything else, there's a certain amount of happy talk out there and this prevailing idea that the kids are going to be all right. And that's something you and I would like to believe, too. And certainly the parents who send their kids onto these campuses want to believe that, too. But what if we've done something so fundamental that we can't reassure ourselves that the kids are going to be all right? That, Todd, I think is the real issue here. It's that the world has changed in a way that humanity has really not seen it change before. We do not live the way human beings have lived in community and in family. We're much more atomized than any generations before 1960. You could have lived in the Middle Ages and you could have had a lifespan of 30 years. You could have been illiterate and lots of other things that we wouldn't want to be, but you would have known who you were and what you were about in a way that many people today really don't know anymore. And that, I think, is the big thing that needs to be wrestled with here. It's the question of what if we really have done something that has unleashed a kind of collective unreason in Western politics via identity politics, and how do we get back to a place where we can be reasonable together again? I don't know the answer to that question. I'm just still trying to understand where it's coming from.
You write about a 1977 document, the Combahee River Collective Statement. What was it about, and why is it in some ways identified as a founding document for identity politics?
Well, that document came out of the deliberations of a group of African-American feminists who had been meeting on and off for years. And the reason why I zero in on that document is twofold. Number one, historians all agree that it is the founding document of identity politics. It talks explicitly about the need to create a group identity in order to free oneself from oppression, etc. Some of the language that we are most familiar with now appears first in that document. But the other reason I zero in on it is that I think it's important to notice when that document was issued. When does identity politics begin? 1976 was the first year in which the rate of unwed motherhood went to 50% for African American women. In the piece, I call this being the canaries in the coal mine of the sexual revolution. This was the first population to be hit hardest by the fracturing of the family, and it cannot possibly be an accident that it's this group of people who issue the first call for identity politics. They're coming out of a place of fracturing and looking for a group with which to associate and identify themselves. And we have seen this more and more over the decades that passed since that document was issued. And again, it can't possibly be a coincidence that 1977 is the year that this document appears, and that it appears at the hands of African-American women, who, again, are the first group victimized en masse by the fallout of the sexual revolution.
A major feature of identity politics as a social issue and as a blight on society, in my opinion, is abortion. But it also would appear to be, at least for the young people today who all grow up realizing they are survivors of potential abortion, a cause. Talk about that, Mary.
That's a real tough one. Abortion, which we usually talk about in terms of the morality of the act, right, has also meant something else, Todd. It has deprived millions of people of siblings, for example. It's contributed to the shrinking of the family. And I think the millennials especially are really deeply schizophrenic about this. I think some of their schizophrenia comes out in their attachment to animal welfare, which I happen to think is a very noble cause. But I think what they tend to do is elide the question of abortion, which they really don't want to think about, and jump to, well, let's talk about what's good for animals instead. Why do they do this? Because I think it's very hard for any generation coming after the legalization of abortion to think about it without, as you say, either seeing themselves as saved or without just buying into the idea that this is the normal world. Nobody born after Roe versus Wade has known any other world than the one in which abortion is legalized and easy to get and, as a consequence, ubiquitous. And I think that in itself is doing quite a lot of psychic damage out there, as well as real-life damage by what it's done to the family.
The Democratic Party has in some ways benefited, in some ways deteriorated on account of identity politics. And part of that debate you mentioned before has to do with that party wondering how much to ally itself with that for political survival. Where does that decision hanging in the balance appear to be headed as far as you're concerned? Will they go with identity politics, or will they distance themselves from it?
Well, again, I think you see an older generation that wants to distance itself, but all of the passion and the political momentum is located in that younger generation that doesn't even think about politics apart from identity politics. So I think this is going to be a big problem for the other side for a long time to come. And I also think that the spectacle that we see on campuses, even as I argue that it's authentically rooted and deeply felt, I think that spectacle at the same time repels people, including people who can't afford to send their children to situations like these, like American universities and colleges, and who see this protest drama, these protest theatrics play out night after night, and wonder just how people can be of such a mind as to do that kind of thing. So what I'm saying is that identity politics, at its most theatrical, is just going to keep codifying what we've been seeing for years, which is the hardening of political differences, the siloing of opinion, and, of course, very divisive politics. So whether there are some people on the left who want to change things or not and soft-pedal identity politics, in a way, it doesn't really matter because they're still going to be stuck with this until the root causes of identity politics are identified and something's done about them.
Finally then, Mary, with only about 30 seconds, in your opinion, have we passed the point of no return? Has this taken on a life of itself that will eventually fracture all of American political life?
You know, in the end, Todd, I am an optimist, at least about the long game, because I think the way we live now is so inhuman and so contrary to our natures that there's going to be some kind of renorming. I think we're seeing that already. There are people who are, in effect, refugees from this broken world. They are the people who are streaming into the churches, even as the churches are losing a lot of people who were only, you know, so attached as believers. They are gaining converts who are there because of the damage of the sexual revolution, who are there because they don't want to raise their own children the way they were raised. And so I think we are going to see, I think we're already seeing, a kind of reawakening out there as a response to the unnaturalness of these very changes that account for identity politics.
Mary Eberstadt is Senior Research Fellow at the Reason to Faith Institute, author of the books It's Dangerous to Believe and How the West Really Lost God, and a recent column for the Weekly Standard titled The Primal Scream of Identity Politics. You can read this column and purchase It's Dangerous to Believe and How the West Really Lost God
at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Mary, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd. It's always a pleasure.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we will look forward to Sunday morning. We'll talk with Dr. Carl Fikancher of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about the parable of the 10 virgins. 5 are foolish and 5 are wise. All fall asleep. The difference comes when the bridegroom comes. And tomorrow, it's our weekly media coverage of religion segment with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.